This is Romantic Circles Audiocast. The audiocast you're listening to is part of a Praxis series volume, Deleuze and Romanticism.
My name is David Balch, and the title of my paper is Representation, Repetition, and Revolution in Deleuze and Blake's America. Tracing the implications of the French Revolution is one of the key intellectual tasks that the study of British Romanticism has assigned itself. The problem that the French Revolution, in all its myriad facets, presents scholarship reflects the divide of its etymological origins. As Raymond Williams has so ably shown, the term indicates both a repetition, the path a planetary body follows until it returns to its original point, and revolution designates a difference, a sweeping change of order and social meaning. The task of this paper is to suggest that Gilles Deleuze's difference in repetition offers a means of intensifying the problem of revolution, even as it demands that we rethink a scholarly approach to it premised on textual representation. At its most basic, what is radical in his approach to difference in repetition is that Deleuze emphasizes difference in itself and repetition for itself. Difference is not the difference between two things or concepts, and repetition is not the recurrence of something, but pure repetition. What this means is that Deleuze's notion of difference and repetition functions without a concept. Deleuze insists that, quote, difference is not and cannot be thought in itself, so long as it is subject to the requirements of representation, close quote. The difference between difference and repetition thus define the fundamental dynamic of what Deleuze discusses as the idea, with a capital I. Deleuzian ideas, ideas without a content, exist in terms of what he calls the virtual, as compared to the traditional notion of ideas being ideas of or about an actual thing. Difficult to imagine? That's just the point. There is no image or representation attendant upon Deleuzian ideas. These ideas are neither bound to the representation of an object or a concept, nor are they the property of individual consciousness. Because Deleuzian ideas are repetitions of the expression of pure difference in the virtual, the idea is the transcendental condition for thought as such. And here is why the Deleuzian idea matters for the study of Romanticism. The study of Romanticism generally proceeds from the premise that revolution is inseparable from its representations. These representations are particular solutions that resolve the problems they address. Revolution, as an idea, demands that we think it as a particular representation of a concept in the actual. By contrast, to think of revolution in terms of a Deleuzian idea is to think revolution as the transcendental condition for the evolution of actual things. Revolution is thus not the solution to a problem, but problematic in itself. As a Deleuzian idea, revolution is the ceaseless creative destruction in the repetition of differences that escape the demands of representation, while making possible, as its transcendental condition, the manifold, irreconcilable meanings of revolution in the actual. In order to explore the potential of this admittedly difficult proposition, this paper turns to William Blake's America, a prophecy. It is tempting, and perhaps necessary, to think the impossible for a Deleuzian reading of America. To think, that is, of Blake writing America as a Deleuzian conversation with Karl Marx's The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. Marx's theory of historical repetition is instructive in its observation that, quote, just when they seem engaged in revolutionizing themselves and things, in creating something entirely new, precisely in such epochs of revolutionary crisis, they anxiously conjure up spirits of the past to their service, close quote. Indeed, in 1793, when the tensions over the French Revolution in England were perhaps at their height, Blake writes America, a text which apparently ends by confirming the conjure trick Marx identified as intrinsic to revolution. Blake's narrator proclaims, France received the demon's light, which is to say that the spirit or demon of the French Revolution is that of the American Revolution. History, it is possible to say, repeats itself here as the transformative process that Marx calls tragic. If we can read America this way, then the French Revolution would become a repetition of the American Revolution. Historically, this is not the case. As Nicholas Williams insists, we must read America in the light of its own historical disconfirmation. For Williams, we must read knowing that Blake's America was, quote, written in the knowledge that the American Revolution has not spread to all other nations of the world, close quote. Perhaps even trying to read the French Revolution as a repetition of the American Revolution in Blake's poem is rushing past the all-too-obvious, for it is precisely upon the question of representation that readings of the poem founder. As Sri Makdisi observes, quote, every step one takes towards pinning down some specific concrete reference to the historical realities or events of the American War of Independence seems ironically to make the prophecy that much more difficult to interpret, close quote. Blake's America resists critical attempts to stabilize it as a field of representation. To take a Deleuzian path, then, is to read America as a rejection of the actual, of material history and individual consciousness, as the only valid description of reality, of the reality of revolution, opting instead to explore reality as influenced by the production of sensations occasioned by the idea of revolution as an indefinite, destabilizing, transformative repetition in the production of pure differences. Deleuze argues that Marx's theory of revolution as an instance of cyclic repetition, quote, does not seem to have been sufficiently understood by historians. Historical repetition is neither a matter of analogy nor a concept produced by reflection of historians, but above all, a condition of historical action itself, close quote. When Marx sets out his theory of historical repetition, wherein history repeats itself, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce, his point was that the tragic metamorphosis of the French Revolution of 1789 had actually created the conditions for its own farcical reprisal in 1848 in the person of Louis Bonaparte, quote, a grotesque mediocrity, close quote, whom Marx asserted played the hero's part. For Deleuze, quote, comic repetition works by means of some defect in the mode of the past. The hero necessarily confronts this repetition so long as the act is too big for him, close quote. Deleuze insists that, quote, these two moments are not independent, existing as they do only for a third moment beyond the comic and the tragic. The production of something new entails a dramatic repetition which excludes even the hero, close quote. This third repetition is Deleuze's notion of the eternal return. It is that which only returns as difference. And it is in this sense of difference that it is the transcendental condition of historical action. To facilitate an exploration of America in terms of these three repetitions, I want to read it with Detlev Doorbecker as a poem composed of three parts: a preludium, a conversation between Orc and Albion's angel, and a mythical version of the events of the American War of Independence. Rather than seeing these parts of the poem as elements in a linear narrative, they can be read of three instances of repetition that explore what is at stake in revolution with regard to its representations. The preludium of America is tragic in the sense that it produces the infinite transformative Deleuzian idea of revolution, the sensations of virtual intensities in the actual, only to witness its loss. Initially, as an indefinite virtual intensity, idea of revolution, Orc receives no clearly defined representation in the first 25 lines. While complaining that he is imprisoned in caverns, Orc can be thought of as a kind of virtual capacity for revolutionary intensity that only expresses itself in the mobile contingency Deleuze calls an assemblage. Held in tenfold change, Orc claims, my spirit soars. Sometimes an eagle screaming in the sky, sometimes a lion stalking upon the mountains, and sometimes a whale I lash the raging fathomless abyss. Anon, a serpent folding around the pillars of Urthona. Here, Orc is not a thing, not a definite being, but an indefinite becoming that emerges in the interchange of virtual intensities and the actual. This sensation repeats itself as instances of difference, a perpetual sometimes multiplicity of otherness. The moment which is most troubling to those who wish to read America as a celebration of the American Revolution is Orc's sudden existence as an actual empirical subject, a definite individual who takes particular actions, the consistency of whose being is determined in its relation to a definite field of representations. Orc takes on direct agency in the poem in his rape of the shadowy daughter of Urthona, whom he sees as his oppressor. Only in this rape is Orc submitted to the regime of representation, and thus recognition. She states, I know thee. And to know is to recognize one thing as an identity that is guaranteed by its determination in a prior representation. Thou art the image of God. Here, as Deleuze says, quote, representation has only a single center, a unique and receding perspective, close quote. By characterizing her rapist as fallen to give me life, Ork is a representation whose content is determined by his victim's Christian narrative. The shadowy daughter is likewise determined by the terrors to which Ork exposes her and her pathological dependence upon him. Deleuze observes, quote, representation fails to capture the affirmed world of difference. It mediates everything, but mobilizes and moves nothing, close quote. The shadowy daughter expresses this condition in the last line of the preludium as eternal death. The sterility of representation in its inevitable recourse to historically prior moments. Like Marx's assessment of the First French Revolution, Ork's revolution is immediately ossified by its own content. The assemblages affected by Ork as an intensity are converted into a series of specific geopolitical determinations. A serpent in Canada, in Mexico an eagle, and a lion in Peru, a whale in the South Seas. In associating plates 3 through 10, the section of America identified by Dorbecker as the conversation between Ork and Albion's angel, with comic repetition, Washington, as the hero of the American War of Independence, is presented as facing an act that is too big for him. The fears Washington expresses seem justified by the dragon-formed appearance of Albion's wrathful prince. Indeed, Washington does not meet his antagonist. Rather, Ork emerges from the Atlantic to announce what sounds more like the dawning of the millennial age than provincial concerns about taxation without representation. While Washington sinks into static insignificance, the verbal battle between Ork and Albion's angel is centered on exactly what it is that Ork represents as a revolutionary force. Here, the idea of revolution is revealed as a product of a representation always tied to the past. Ork claims to represent revolution as the fulfillment of eschatological history, while Albion's angel sees Ork's revolution as a representation that repeats the moment of his own historical origin. Either way, Ork as a revolutionary has no capacity to break free of the past. While in the preludium, Ork becomes a representation that receives its determination in relation to a Christian narrative, in the prophecy proper, Ork sees himself as the agent of that history in its final and presumably transformative end. As such, Ork represents revolution as apocalypse and millennium, proclaiming the grave is burst, and the times are ended. Such claims in the name of revolution designate it as the small I idea of an end in humanity's final determination in God's being. For Ork, the American Revolution is, by analogy, the representation of the eschatological end of time. In repeating a historically prior representation, Ork's revolution is incapable of producing difference in itself. In an ironic contrast, Albion's angel recognizes Ork as a representation that repeats his own historical revolutionary origin. Upon seeing the fiery Ork emerge from the Atlantic, Albion's angel recognizes him as both Mars and Ork. He reflects on the past and says, "Then, Mars, thou wast our center." Troping a Marxist view of history as the history of revolutionary action in celestial form, Ork is recognized as the gravitational spiritual center that governed the planetary and political revolutions that constitute the very content of Albion's angel as a representation. In response to Ork's claim that the times are ended, Albion's angel responds that the times are returned upon thee. For him, Ork is a rebel form, self-renewed, and a devourer of thy parent. In this way, Albion's angel sees himself confronted by a repetition of his own historical origin, rather than an end of history. Thus, the conflict between Ork and Albion's angel is primarily over what determines revolution's content. Interestingly, America never definitively resolves the question of what the American Revolution represents. Ork represents revolutionary action, whatever its content, in the actual. But America suggests that there is a resistant, virtual dimension that impinges upon the actual, that an irresolvable problematic of revolution as Deleuzian idea is a necessary condition for a future beyond the historical repetitions of eternal death. While the question of the second section might be summarized as, what does revolution represent? The question of the third section of the poem, plates 10 through 16, might be summarized as, how can revolution be freed from representation altogether? Perhaps the decisive moment in America is where almost any sense of the poem's imagery's capacity to sustain representations collapses. On plate 10, Albion's angel commands his 13 colonial governors to take action, but they refuse. Silent, the colonies remained and refused the loud alarm. On those vast, shady hills between America and Albion's shore, now barred out by the Atlantic, called Atlantean Hills, because from their bright summits you may pass to the Golden World, an ancient palace archetype of mighty emperors, rears its immortal pinnacles, but in the built in the forest of God, by Astrian, king of beauty, for his stolen bride. Here on their magic seats the 13 angels perturbed, for clouds from the Atlantic hover o'er the solemn roof. This passage is infamous in America's critical history because it refuses to clarify either its relationship to the poem or its allegory of the American Revolution. For the purposes of this paper, I want to read this passage as suggesting that revolutionary action demands the transcendence of history and its representations in the expression of pure difference. Yes, Blake's poem operates through the production of images, but these are images which destabilize the representations necessary for the poem's allegory. The passage to the Golden World and its magic seats allows the 13 angels to dissolve their identities, and thus it permits a freedom from the determinations of representation. This strange passage allows the poem, as Dorbecker puts it, to transcend the level of historical narrative. The 13 are described as rending off the robes, their robes, to the hungry wind, and throwing down the emblems of their power. This removal of their robes is, of course, their rejection of their roles as surrogates for Albion's angel in the American colonies. But it is more than that. It is their abandonment of identity altogether in the becoming fire of revolutionary intensity. They escape logical determination. Now both, quote, naked and flaming are their lineaments seen in the deep gloom by Washington and Payne and Warren, close quote. The named heroes are stationary observers in the face of this revolutionary intensity. In rejecting the marks of their political and human determinations to become common expressions of an intensity, the 13 foment revolutionary change within the poem. Following their example, the citizens of the colonies all set aside their identities, occupations, and geographical locations to become, quote, a fierce rushing of the inhabitants together, close quote. What is crucial here is that revolutionary change is not so much a political opposition as it is a dissolution of individuality. As Makdisi observes of this passage of America, quote, the individuals are absorbed into the crowd that they constitute, not simply by losing but altogether detonating their prior individuality, close quote. In losing their individuality in a moment of becoming revolution, America expresses revolution as sensation and movement, quote, all rush together in the night, in wrath and raging fire, the red fires raged, close quote. Wrath and raging fire are the sensations produced by this rushing all. No longer a group of autonomous individuals, but an expression of a revolutionary intensity that transcends clear determinations of subject and object. The lines between affect and object blur. Mass sensations consume the individual. Movement has only velocity and intensity. Blake's America thus suggests Deleuze's notion of a third repetition beyond Marx's too, wherein the big eye idea of revolution destabilizes representation. In this third repetition, this third way of thinking revolution in the poem, pure differences in the virtual have an effect on the actual as the sensations generated by intensities. Thus, the Deleuzian achievement of America's treatment of revolution suggests that the connections between the actual and the virtual are the condition of historical action, regardless of the way history is represented. But what does a Deleuzian idea of revolution allow us to envision as a future? It is impossible to say. Revolution without representation is a commitment to a future without a guarantee of comprehensible meaning or morality. And it is for this reason that Deleuze characterizes the third repetition as a throw of the dice, or a kind of creative destruction. Still, the question remains as to what it accomplishes to say that America can be read as a negotiation of the Deleuzian distinction between the idea of revolution and the idea of revolution. Reading Blake's poem in Deleuzian terms suggests what I think is a legitimately Blakean alternative to seeing the poem as neither referring exclusively to the material world nor wholly to the idiosyncratic world of Blake's vision. The former cannot limit itself to elaborate allegorizations of actual material political world as a reality, and the latter cannot simply advocate the transcendence of reality to constitute a different world through imaginative vision. The Deleuzian lesson for reading of Blake's America is its constant reminder of the instability of the subject as a fiction of representation, a fiction whose meaning is only guaranteed by its external determinations, its difference from something. Finally, the Deleuzian point of revolution in America is that it must be thought outside of its representations to produce the conditions for real historical difference.